It's Sunday, and I'm back with Yaakov Katz. But it's not just any Sunday. Today is April 7th, exactly 6 months since October 7th. We are still at war in Gaza. The conflict in the north is intensifying, and 133 hostages are still being held by Hamas. The body of 42-year-old Elad Katsir, who was murdered after 3 months in captivity and buried near Khan Yunis, was exhumed and repatriated for burial in Israel late last week. It was a devastating blow for the hostage families and the nation, but there was also so much more that went on last week. A few hours after we recorded this morning, Yaakov and I learned that the IDF is implementing a partial withdrawal from the Gaza Strip, effective immediately. In fact, it began this morning, but was not reported until the afternoon. I think that the whole country was quite shocked. But when you look at what went down last week, it begins to make a lot of sense. On Monday, Israel bombed the diplomatic residence of the Islamic Republic of Iran in Damascus. One of the most important IRGC generals was killed, along with quite a few other high-ranking military officials. Iran promised harsh and swift retaliation. Israel was on edge. In the early morning on Tuesday, 7 humanitarian aid workers with the American NGO World Central Kitchen were traveling in a convoy in the Gaza Strip that was hit by Israeli drones. All were killed instantly. It was tragic, and the IDF almost immediately claimed responsibility. The military also admitted that numerous protocols had been breached, but the damage was done, and President Biden was hopping mad. Then, on Thursday, the national security advisors of the U.S. and Israel had what is reported to have been a very combative two-hour Zoom meeting. It was about Rafah. Israel was determined to launch an assault on the southern city where Hamas power is now concentrated. President Biden's team has made it clear for some time that the civilian toll in the war is unconscionably high, in their view, and cannot continue. They asked Israel to present a plan to accomplish its military goals in Rafah while protecting civilians. What Minister Dermer and National Security Advisor Tzachi Hanegbi presented was dismissed by the Americans as being utterly inadequate. Biden and his team, I believe, were beyond fed up. It's pretty clear that there was a lot of intense negotiating going on last week. Likely more than a few backs were pressed to the wall. What is clear as well is that Israel agreed to a partial withdrawal from the Gaza Strip, meaning that it is understood that Israel will move on Rafah at some point and will continue to engage in focused operations in the Gaza Strip as necessary. And what's the quid pro quo? Well, I'm going to speculate that talks in Cairo will yield results quickly, and there will be significant movement with respect to hostage releases. Hamas will likely receive significant material incentives for any movement in their position regarding hostages. Oh, and then there's the weird sort of sidebar story of the editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post, who spent a few days last week hosted by the Qataris in Doha. Weird. And now the reason for the visit and the timing suddenly make a lot more sense. We get into all this and more. Yeah, it was quite a week. I'm Vivian Berkovich, former Canadian ambassador to Israel, and now living in the crazy, amazing state of Tel Aviv. Stay with us.
It's Sunday. So great to have you back, Yaakov Katz.
It's great to be back with you.
We had a little last-minute glitch last week when you were unable to join me and our listeners missed you. And then we had an exchange during the week, and I understand you popped off to Italy?
I popped off to Italy for a couple of quick days, yes.
Very nice. And where in Italy?
The north, the Alps, a little break from the chaos and craziness that we all live with here. And while there's always a tinge of guilt leaving the country at a time like this. It's also, I feel like a breather is so needed, and it was the right thing.
I have to tell you, I've been fantasizing constantly about getting into the mountains. I just need space, quiet, and fresh mountain air. So we'll talk after, and you'll give me a few tips where I can sort of pop off for a few days and restore, have some restorative energy. Listeners, it's difficult days. They're difficult days in Israel, and it takes a toll, I think, on everybody.
Yeah.
You know, what I want to do now is just kind of, before we dive into the guts of all these issues, I want to set the table with respect to how I see last week having played out, because it was pretty extraordinary, even for Israel. I'm starting to sound like a broken record. I think I say that every week. But I mean, we started off again, no movement on the hostages, extreme frustration. The week, of course, begins in Israel on Sunday, but on Monday, there is a quite significant airstrike by Israel on what appears to be an ambassadorial or a diplomatic residence of the Islamic Republic of Iran in Damascus. And it's where...
By the way, right next to the Canadian embassy
yes.
in Damascus. So, strangely yes. enough, right.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that got a lot of attention in Canada. But it appeared to be the residence for some very significant higher-up IRGC officials, including a very senior general. They were all killed in that strike in Damascus. And then later that day or early morning on Tuesday, there was, of course, the strike on the World Central Kitchen convoy, humanitarian convoy of food aid workers. That's very controversial and has mired the IDF and Israel in a lot of discussion abroad, more abroad than here, I have to say. And then Iran stating, we're coming at you. We are going to retaliate, and we're going to retaliate hard, and we're going to do it in a way that will kind of knock your socks off. And I was reading earlier today that they've apparently been mulling and have made the statement now that they will be hitting Israel directly. We in Israel, listeners, have been sitting here thinking, oh my gosh, Iran, like, where does that go? What happens? There are so many different scenarios that you can kind of play out that, of course, we'll get into with Yaakov. And among other things I learned, because I'm not a military security weapons guy like you, Yaakov, that Israel apparently has no defensive capability to protect population or the infrastructure or anything from drones. Like, this is what we call asymmetric warfare. They fly at a low altitude. They fly slowly, but we-
Harder to detect and as a result, harder to intercept, yes.
And we've had a few trial runs, we know, where drones were shot at Eilat, and I think a few up in the north, and one or two got through, and some were intercepted. And then on top of that, we have the hostage crisis, which is, it's just kind of, it's meltdown time. It's 6 months today. There was confirmation of the death of another hostage on Friday who had been murdered after 3 months in captivity, but we only received intelligence of his death on Friday, I believe.
His body was here.
Correct. Yeah. His body was repatriated to Israel and buried, and that has been a huge blow to the families and to the nation. And then all the usual demonstrations. So that's the table. And at the end of the week, Yaakov has a fantastic column every Friday in the Jerusalem Post weekend edition. And if you don't read it, you should. And you sum things up very well this week, Yaakov, by saying, we're stuck. Yeah. I mean, I've just kind of set the table and put everything on. What do we do with it? Do we
eat? It's so much. I mean,
it's so much. Let's start with Iran.
I mean, look, the way I look at Iran, and, you know, I was talking with some intelligence officials, current and former, and trying to understand the bigger picture here, right? Israel and Iran, let's just understand, have been embroiled now in direct conflict since October 7th, right? It's, you know, it might be Hezbollah or the Houthis who are firing drones and missiles at Israel from Lebanon and from Yemen and occasionally also from Syria. But this is Iran. Right. And Iran until now has pretty much had complete immunity, has never really paid any direct cost. And here was an operational opportunity that presented itself. This General Zahedi had been on Israel's wanted list for some time. he was in Damascus. Israel had the operational capability, and it took him out. Now, we have to assume, Vivian, that in these pre-operational discussions, when the military and the Mossad or brings this to the cabinet for approval, there is a discussion, okay, what is going to be the fallout? What's going to be the reaction? And I think we can assume, and also from what I've heard, that the intelligence officials estimated, now we still don't know, and every assessment is only worth as much as the words that they say, and we know that since October 7th, definitely, but the assessment was and remains that Iran will retaliate in a way that remains pretty much within the scope of what we've grown accustomed to some extent since October 7th. You know, Hezbollah has been firing hundreds, if not thousands of missiles by now into Israel, anti-tank missiles, some drones. They've, you know, the Houthis have launched ballistic missiles and drones into Eilat, as you mentioned. Now, could Iran do something a little bigger? Could they use Hezbollah to fire deeper into Israel, maybe to Haifa? Could they maybe attack an Israeli consulate or embassy overseas? There are reports over the weekend that Israel has evacuated about 30 of those around the world as of now because of the potential threat. We've seen Iran, by the way, do this. In 1992, they attacked the Israeli embassy in Buenos Aires after an Israeli helicopter blew up a Mercedes sedan in southern Lebanon and killed Abbas Mousawi, who was the head of Hezbollah. 2 years later, Iran blew up the Jewish Community Center in Buenos Aires in the same city. So they have this capability. They've used it before. They could potentially do it again. They've tried over the years. But again, I want to just take us back. Whatever they might do, the assessment is and was that it won't be anything extraordinary that would lead to an all-out war with Iran, aka Hezbollah, for that matter, right? So that's the Iranian thing. And I would leave it as, you know, kind of isolated, obviously interconnected, but it's a different front. It's not the same as everything we're seeing, how we're stuck in Gaza, we're stuck on the hostages, we're stuck on the day after. All of that is a separate component to some extent.
So not overly concerned from what I'm hearing about any Iranian response. And what I've heard from others who, everybody in Israel has their people, and I probably speak to overlap with you somewhat, but we speak to lots of people in the intelligence and defense and political communities. And if I could reduce all of the comments to one thing, I would say that paper tiger comes up a lot. The Iranians, you know, there is a lot of bark, but not a lot of bite. And I just,
you have to look at you have to differentiate between two different things. Iran as Iran itself,
right?
Their ability to attack Israel is extremely limited. We do not share a border. They can't send their soldiers over to Israel. They're not going to send Iranian soldiers through Iraq into Syria, up to the border with the Golan Heights. They'd never make it here. It would take them who knows how long. And they stand no chance. What they could potentially do is fire ballistic missiles at Israel. Okay, that's always a possibility. Israel has capabilities to defend itself to some extent, the Arrow 2 and the Arrow 3. And if they were to fire long-range ballistic missiles from Iran to Israel, it would open itself up to a direct attack by Israel, which is the last thing that the Iranians want. So that's one.
But the reality is that Iran has its proxies, as you said earlier.
Correct.
That's
what I was going to say. So their proxies is the big threat, and that's Hezbollah. Right. And Hezbollah is a massive threat against the state of Israel. But we've been playing with the idea of this war with Hezbollah since October 7th, right? So it's not anything necessarily new. The war with Hezbollah has been in the cards. It's been on the table. Personally, I think maybe the time has come for that war to happen, as terrible as it will be. But it makes no sense that we continue to live with this threat on our northern border.
Right.
And it's a threat that has to be dealt with today, tomorrow, 5 years, 10 years. It's going to one day have to be dealt with. I hope we don't get there. I hope that this doesn't lead to that war. But everything we've seen in the last 6 months, Vivian, is that Hezbollah doesn't want an all-out war. So this one guy is going to change that ultimate calculation. I understand the intelligence officials who estimated it won't. They could always be wrong, but I could see where they're coming from.
Yeah, but in the meantime, we have over 100,000 people who live in the north who have been displaced for 6 months now. And we have to find some kind of solution as a country. We either decide, all right, we're just not going to inhabit the north any longer, or we're going to do something to make it so that Israelis feel safe living in that area. And that's kind of where we are now.
Don't get me wrong. As of now, when we speak on April 7th, 6 months into this war, we have lost the war in the north for one very simple reason. Yeah, and we may have killed more Hezbollah guys than they've killed of us. We may have destroyed more Hezbollah infrastructure than they've destroyed of ours. But the fact of the matter is that we have created, like you just said, a buffer zone within a security zone within the state of Israel, within right. our territory. That is goes against everything upon which the national defense doctrine of this country rests, right? That means we've given up, we've ceded territory effectively to Hezbollah. That is a huge loss. We have to regain that territory. To regain that territory, either there's a diplomatic solution that pushes Hezbollah north, or there's a war. So as of now, I agree. This is not sustainable. This has to change. I don't know what the end result will be. It might have to be armed conflict in a bigger way than we've seen until now with Hezbollah, or it could be a diplomatic resolution. But by the way, whatever Hezbollah and Iran do now will also dictate what Israel's response will be. So if they fire missiles into Tel Aviv, we would assume Israel is going to have to retaliate, like firing missiles into Beirut, maybe. And then the next thing you know, you're in, you know, one thing, it's like a domino effect. One thing leads to the other. Yeah. Everybody understands this.
What about swarms of drones, Yaakov? Swarms of attack drones. They could do it.
They could do that. Listen, Vivian, I never want to sound like I'm underestimating or underappreciating the enemy, right? And they have capabilities and they could cause us damage. But Israel, we always have to remember, we are a very strong military. Now, we screwed up in like the biggest way imaginable. And the fact that some of these generals are still in their jobs drives me crazy every single day. However, the military, as we've seen in Gaza, and we'll get to Gaza, I know, and you know, the fact that now we're a bit stuck, that's a separate issue. But what you've seen in Gaza in the last 6 months is that nothing can stand in the way of Israeli ground forces. Nothing can stand in the way of the Israeli Air Force, right? Every enemy force that comes against it, they inflict damage, they inflict casualties, but we demolish them along the way. That's the reality. The same would ultimately, at a greater, steeper price, would happen with Hezbollah, I have no doubt. We would pay a price for it. It would be devastating, potentially. You know, we're as strong also to an extent as we demonstrate. And we have to demonstrate strength. We can't just demonstrate fear and weakness.
Are we demonstrating strength in
Gaza? No, and that's the big problem. I agree. And, you know, when last week people were buying generators and taking cash out of ATMs and, you know, filling up in water, and you know, I was waiting to see the toilet paper and paper towel, you know, reenactment from COVID once again. No, that doesn't show strength. I mean, you know, and I understand why. Look, we're still hurting. We're wounded from October 7th. That scar has not, that wound has not healed. And that scar will take generations to potentially go away. But we also shouldn't underestimate what we're capable of doing as a country and as a military. And I think that the last 6 months, to some extent, show that. It shows also the incompetence sometimes when you don't have the diplomatic and political train moving alongside the military train. But in the big picture, I'm not overly worried.
Are you concerned with what is going on in Israel? This is not just another crisis. State of Tel Aviv is committed to delivering superb and candid analysis, and we're offering a limited-time subscription special, a 33% discount from the regular fee of $90 annually. 1 year for only $60. Stay informed and stay connected with State of Tel Aviv. We are a reader-supported enterprise. If you value our work, please subscribe. It makes a huge difference. stateoftelaviv.com. All one word. Now, back to the podcast.
Let's talk about those diplomatic and military trains. Glad you brought those up. There were reports about a rather stormy meeting between Ron Dermer and Tzachi Hanegbi on the Israeli side. Ron Dermer, of course, former ambassador to the United States, very close confidant of Prime Minister Netanyahu's. Tzachi Hanegbi is the national security advisor, and they were having apparently a two-hour chat with their peers in the U.S., in which, you know, news reports say, you know, Dermer was raising his voice and waving his arms, which, I mean, he's an expressive guy anyhow, so that didn't shock me. But what they're arguing about is Rafah, and what's going on. As you said in your column, we're stuck. We seem stuck. We've been talking about Rafah now for months. And what Dermer and Hanegbi did was to present the U.S. with a so-called plan, how they're going to manage a Rafah offensive and minimize civilian casualties and humanitarian distress. And what they apparently presented to the Americans was considered to be wildly insufficient. And I believe that one of the Americans said something to the effect that there were so many gaping holes in the plan, even if they followed it, it would take 9 months to evacuate civilians into tents and put them in safe zones. It was just apparently not credible. What do you know about that?
You know, someone explained to me over Shabbat, that we're no longer in, I'm going to say this in Hebrew, but then I'll translate. We're no longer in a matzav milchama. We're no longer in a war situation. We're in a matzav lechima. We're in a combat situation. And the difference basically is, when you look at Gaza, is that, you know, we in the beginning, we were at war. We were going in with divisions and brigades and units, and we were conquering territory, and we were destroying enemy targets. And basically now, yeah, there are operations. And as we saw over the weekend, a very unfortunate loss of 4 soldiers in a clash with terrorists and another several wounded. There is fighting going on. This is what happens. This is an area which still has a significant number of terrorists and armed Hamas terrorists who want to kill and kidnap Israelis, right? So that is a fighting combat situation, but it's not the war situation. And the question really is, what does Israel want and where's it going? Because this has already been the situation now for about a month. We finished up in the north. We had that great operation, Shifa, very incredible. But again, the Shifa operation where you rounded up all those bad guys, that's a fighting combat situation. That's not a war. That's an operation. What we're doing in Khan Yunis, continuing to clean out some of those areas, that's continued fighting. That's not war. Rafah would be a continuation of war. And here, Israel and the Americans do not see it the same way, particularly because of the fact, and if you look at, I mean, the footage is out there, right? There are displaced Palestinians all across the border. They're everywhere, right? All across Rafah and across the border with Egypt. And everybody's very concerned of what would happen. Now, in this conversation that the Israelis had with the Americans came up the idea of how long would it take to evacuate them. The Israelis spoke about 4 weeks. The Americans spoke about 4 months or even longer, about five. You spoke about 9 months. The question that I wonder is, if we're going into Rafah, why are we not starting to move in that direction? Why haven't we done anything? Why haven't we dropped leaflets? Why haven't we asked people to move north? Why haven't we asked the people to leave? I think that there's a lot of different pieces here to this puzzle, right? And this is what makes it so complicated. Rafah, on the one hand, still has about 4 or 5 battalions of Hamas. They need to be eliminated. It has terror tunnels that go into Egypt that they use to bring in weapons, mostly from Iran. Those need to be destroyed. That's one. Something needs to happen in Rafah. Two, there are probably hostages in Rafah. Maybe we could rescue some. Don't know. Three, you have a lot of displaced. You have a million, 1.2, 1.3, even more million Palestinians who are now in that area. How do you move them? Number four, you have the hostage deal. We have a new round of talks in Cairo today, right? Now, you're going to start moving out Palestinians. Then there might be a deal. And when there's a deal, you're going to have to stop everything because there's a ceasefire. So was it worth fighting now with the Americans and the Egyptians and everyone else about moving again displaced Palestinians for the purpose of just a ceasefire, if you're not actually going through with the Rafah operation? And then five is the Americans say, and there are some people also within the Israeli defense establishment who say, guys, listen, you're 6 months into this war. Do you really want another 3, 4, 5, 8 months long operation just for Rafah? Keep Rafah isolated. Do what you have to do. Go in when you need, hit from the air, send in special forces, go in on the ground, pinpointed focused operations like you did at Shifa, but not in a big way. Maybe that's the better option. And you know what? I listen to both sides and I say, I hear that and I hear that. I don't know what the right decision will be. But as we're talking about all this, though, it's hard to walk away it's hard to kick the feeling that we are a bit stuck. We're trying to hold everything together. And it's not simple.
So we've been focusing in this discussion on the civilian government and how it's approaching the Rafah situation. And of course, they have the last say and they are the main kind of interlocutors with the U.S. But so are the military officials. And so is the war cabinet. Do you have any insight into how the war cabinet, in particular, I'm interested in Benny Gantz, Gadi Eisenkot, see this situation?
Look, Benny Gantz has said publicly, and he went to Washington and said this to the Americans, is that we need to go into Rafah. At the same time, Gantz, and particularly his partner Gadi Eisenkot, have prioritized a hostage deal as being the number one issue. Dermer believes very strongly that Rafah needs to happen. He has said that publicly. He said that privately. Netanyahu is the one who talks about total victory. But again, Netanyahu, you can never really know where he is on things. So I think that the government as a whole would agree to an operation in Rafah if there is an operational capability. But they also understand that if there is a deal that presents itself to get the hostages, they are going to have to prioritize that. And I think that maybe under these circumstances, see, here's the problem, right? If we give up Rafah, we say, no, we're not going in. We're prioritizing hostages. That's what we want. Then Hamas says, I got all the time in the world because why am I under pressure? They're not coming into Rafah. So Israel is kind of using Rafah as a sword over Sinwar and the Hamas leadership to threaten them with, to try to get them to move faster on a hostage deal. But really, Rafah and the hostage deal don't go together. And that's what makes this super, super complicated.
Okay, so let's make it a little more complicated now. We just, we're a laugh a minute, you and me. There was a lot of stuff written in the weekend papers about the hostages and about negotiations around their fate. So let me just kind of, again, throw it all out at you because I think everyone needs to kind of hear it all and then we can work our way through it. There was a report, I believe it was in the Jerusalem Post, that said that, in fact, there were some credible negotiation offers made by Hamas in October before the IDF even had boots on the ground in the Gaza Strip. And that they were never properly responded to. Now, what I read in the paper, and you may know more, is that there were, everything was chaotic, which we know. We knew at the time, and we certainly know in hindsight. It was unclear what they were dealing with. It never actually, if there was any kind of offer, it never made it to the right place in terms of being considered seriously. First of all, on that point, do you have any information or insight with respect to the credibility of that report?
That report, I think, was in the Jerusalem Post and was part of a package of articles that the paper came out with on Friday of Qatar and different.
Okay. Yeah, I want to hold the Qatar part. We're going to slice the salami. First, just that report.
It's hard to say, but that report comes from the Qataris, right? We have to say where it came from. It came from the Qataris, it was their claim. I have no way of knowing whether it's true or not.
So now let me just explain the larger context. The Jerusalem Post this weekend was basically about a trip taken by the editor-in-chief, Zvika Klein. I guess last week he spent a few days in Doha. He wrote about how he was hosted in a really lovely glamping site. He had a series of meetings with senior Qatari officials, none of whom, of course, could be identified. And it was an odd set of articles, basically, in my view, setting out what I would call a Qatari charm offensive. Qatar, on the one hand, has been vilified in the West for being a significant financial and other sponsor of Islamist terrorism, Iran, Houthi, Hezbollah, Hamas. Qatar also hosts the largest U.S. military base in the Middle East.
Right.
That arrangement was just extended for another 10 years in recent months. The alliance, such as it is obviously useful to both parties. Qatar is defenseless without the U.S. presence, and for the U.S., it gives them a very nice foothold in the region from which to deploy. It seemed to me right from the outset of this, when Qatar presented as the mediator for hostage negotiations, they were sort of taking a very opportunity to rehabilitate their own image in the West and get into the room and present themselves as the moderates, the true moderates, who without whom the Middle East would absolutely just fall apart. It's bold, and they've got some great crisis comms advisors, clearly, crisis communications advisors. and they're out to rehabilitate their image. And they thought, well, who can we conscript to assist us in getting out our message cleanly? And they decided on the Jerusalem Post. Now, you and I know that's always a tough call for a if you're being invited and sponsored in that way. You don't have freedom of movement. You can't identify your sources. It was pretty kind of light reporting. It was all very positive. What it's doing is helping the Qataris get out the image that Israel is the irascible, recalcitrant party. It's Benjamin Netanyahu, which may be true, but we're the good guys. We've been trying and trying since October 7th to work out a hostage deal. And it's because of your government stuck. Take it away, Yaakov.
Look, I think very highly of Tzvika Klein, who is my successor as editor of the Jerusalem Post. I think he's a really great journalist. And I think that what he did here with the Qatari report was very complicated and very difficult. And I, you know, it's sometimes it's easy to look at things from the outside and say, you know, it could have been more balanced. It should have been more critical. It could have been, you know, better reported, this, that, and the other. And all that criticism is legitimate. I'm not saying it's not. But I think that what he was dealing with here was the opportunity to gain access, create contacts, and get insight into a country that has become a significant and I would say almost existential player for Israel, especially when it comes to the hostages. There's no one else, right? We need to work with the Qataris, whether we like it or not.
I want to jump in very quickly. Number one, just to make clear, Tzvika isn't the originator of this work with the Qataris thing. I mean, this has been very entrenched in the government. Secondly, I am making no personal comment on Tzvika Klein or casting any aspersions. I just want to be very clear about that. I don't know him personally, but he has an excellent reputation. I'm trying to treat the issue as a global and a real issue. And God knows what I would do if the Qataris came to me and said, hey, come on for 3-4 days. I might
So that's exactly what I was going to say, is that what I think we need to understand, you know, we're dealing with an integral player now in the Middle East, on the world stage, and definitely with everything that pertains to this conflict. As a journalist, you're given an opportunity to go there to get access, to hear a version and a side of the story that you don't have and is not out there. Now, it's one-sided. It is the Qatari side. And we all know that Qatar is a, I would say, complicated / dangerous / toxic actor, right? They've supported Hamas. They claim that we asked them to, but they funded Hamas. They continue to provide sanctuary for Hamas leaders who live in Doha. You know, they talk to the Iranians, they talk to the Taliban, they play it good with everybody. On the other hand, they're welcomed in Washington and they're welcomed around the world. And Israel has, yes, asked them to be a facilitator in a lot of these cases, in the money that was paid off to Hamas over the years since 2018, and also when it comes to the hostages.
They're Switzerland.
There's something like Switzerland, although maybe a little worse than Switzerland.
Switzerland-ish. Switzerland, yes. Okay.
However, I think that, you know, on the journalistic level, I was thinking about this. I knew that Tzvika was going and I knew that he was there. And, you know, it's a complicated position to be in. Now, once you're in that position, it's going to be difficult to come out looking good on any side. For the Qataris who hosted you, who expect you to give, you know, their version. For the people who, because you have to balance it out. And of course, they don't want it balanced out. For the people who think it should have been balanced out, maybe more criticism than the criticism that you might have put in there. So you're going to be in an impossible situation. I think that the way he did it was possibly the best way possible. And I don't know that I could have done it better or different, but I think the one decision you could have made is not to put yourself in that position. That would have been the one possible way to avoid this. But I think there was also journalistic value in getting and hearing that version, which again, we don't know. And you spoke about, you know, did that happen? Did that not happen? We don't know, but it's interesting now to have that version out there.
It is. I think there are a couple of things I would have appreciated as a reader. One would be if Tzvika had taken the opportunity to press his hosts, his Qatari hosts, on the issue of why they continue to so nicely host Hamas leaders and their families. And why they continue to give them access to huge amounts of cash. Why have they not put that pressure on them to force a deal? They have all the levers in their hands. They have the leaders who they take care of, and they have their money. And to my knowledge, they've never used either of those levers. And I read all of the coverage, and I saw no reference to any discussion of that nature. You know, could have asked the, okay, I'm just saying, like, he could have asked the question, and correct, they wouldn't answer, or, you know, they might get sullen with him for a few minutes. But I'd like to know if it was even considered. And if not, why? Because that's such an obvious one. And that's something that's talked about frequently. Why don't the Qataris use their levers? And they don't, from what it seems. The other thing is, you know, just apropos the kind of the temptation, someone, you know, calls Tzvika Klein and says, hey, you know, got this great thing set up. We want you to come and do the interview. I mean, it's, you know, reminds me a bit of, you know, Tucker Carlson scoring the Putin gig, right? And then all the other journalists saying, you know, F you. Well, the truth is, they all would have jumped at it too, including Christiane Amanpour. They may not like how it went. They may not like that it was Tucker who got it, but Tucker got it. So Tzvika got the brass ring this time. But, you know, I would have liked to have known if he spoke at all with his hosts about his dilemma as a journalist from an independent media organization, the dilemma it put him in. That to me is interesting, and I think it would be to a lot of people. Why did they go to the Jerusalem Post and not the Times of Israel and not Haaretz? I mean, I would have thought they would go to Haaretz. So there are lots of calculations here about why they chose that outlet.
I think that, you know, the Qataris are not lacking at all in resources and are not lacking at all. And, you know, you called them what, the crisis communication?
Yeah, they've got great advisors.
They've got great advisors. They got people all over the world. They have people in America. They have people in Europe. They have people in Israel who I'm sure are working for them. They have people everywhere, and they are all thinking about how to get positive media coverage for them and to tell their story. And if there's anything that's important to the Qataris, it is their image of how they're perceived and how they're looked at around the world. This is of extreme importance to them. So you could say, you know, why the Jerusalem Post? I don't know. I there might be a relationship there. There might be some connection there. It's a newspaper that kind of serves, on the one hand, Israel, but also the world. So it would get, right, it would get their, you know, get eyeballs on that, not just local, but around the world. And it seems that it's a choice. You know, if you want to impact Israeli public opinion, go for Yisrael Hayom or Yedioth Ahronot. If you're looking to impact global Jewish opinion as well as, you know, foreign policy circles, then the Jerusalem Post might be a better option. So that also gives you some indication maybe of what they're thinking.
Yeah.
It's a very complex and difficult position to be in. Hard to navigate. I feel, you know, many journalists have been in positions like this before. Never easy to come out looking okay on all sides. And sometimes, right, Vivian, let me tell you that I learned this through a long, almost 8 years as being editor of that newspaper, when everybody's upset at you from both sides. And again, I don't know the discussions that Tzvika might have had with the Qatari people and if they're upset or they're not, I don't know. But if that is the case that everybody's upset at him from all over the place, then he might have done something right.
Absolutely. But we don't know any of that.
Correct.
So they're doing this ultimately in connection with the hostages and how they're perceived as effective, compassionate mediators in an unprecedented crisis that's still going on. And we're all sitting here kind of worried, sick, 6 months on. What can they do? Like, what is, okay, you set the stage, Qataris. You got this great press. Now show us what you can do.
You know, it's all going to be a question of how hard are they going to come down on Hamas? And are they using all the leverage that they have possible? We will probably say they're not, right? They could kick them out of Doha, but they'll say keeping them in Doha is what gives us the access. You know, I don't know the right move here. I know that the Qataris, in my view, you know, I've written about this and I've spoken about this, they are a toxic actor, right? And they have, you know, played both sides for way too long, and this is ridiculous. And if there's anything in the post-October 7th world, see this, I wonder, the post-October 7th world should make things a little more black and white for us, right? We should have a clear concept of who is good and who is bad, who is with us and who is not with us. That should be the case. And I feel to an extent that all these conversations we have about the Altani royal family and the and you know, it's complicated. We need them. We don't need them. You know what we need to do, Vivian, in my opinion? And it's easy to say, right? Very easy for Yaakov Katz to say. It's easy to say. But what we should be doing is should say to the world and to the people like the Qataris and terrorist organizations, pardon my language, fuck you. You guys have long enough played both sides of this. It's time for us to put an end to it. And the fact that Ismail Haniyeh and Abu Marzouk and some of these other guys are still, you know, gallivanting around the Middle East on jets to Iran and to Syria and living it up in the lap of luxury in Doha at the Four Seasons or who knows where is insane, in my opinion.
So today is a really solemn day. It is the 6 months to the day anniversary of October 7th. It's April 7th. There are a number of events going on today in Israel. There's a commemoration at the Nova Music Festival site. There's also going to be a very large protest in Jerusalem tonight outside the Knesset, basically saying to the government, we've had enough of you, step down. We want elections and get the damn hostages out. God knows how many are still alive, which I think is something that hangs over this country significantly. So last words on this stuck day of some solemnity. Leave us with some hope, Yaakov.
I thought I gave some hope before when I said we're strong and we can stand up to the Iranians. Listen, the words of hope that I have really, I mean, 6 months, it's remarkable. It's mind-blowing that it's been 6 months since October 7th. It really does, I'm sure feels like that for you, for so many people. That time stopped to some extent on October 7th. And the fact that we're still here and we're talking about all these different issues, the fact that there's still 134 bodies alive.
133.
Right, because that one was brought back, Elad Katsir.
Correct.
It's just horrific. But with that said, I really think that we have to remember that we are strong, that we are capable. We can't let every single threat hold us back. And we also have to be, in my view, and like we were talking about just now about the Qataris, we have to be clear on what it is that we want, what it is that we want to achieve, and what is the strategy for getting there. And that applies to Gaza. It applies to the hostages. It applies to Iran and to Hezbollah. The post-October 7th world needs to be one of more clarity for Israel and more straightforwardness. And I fear that we might have had that in the beginning, but we've lost it now a bit. And that's unfortunate.
Well, that was a cheerful note on which to end. Thanks, Yaakov. You sort of started with this burst of energy.
I leave the cheeriness to you.
Oh, no, that's not my shtick. Look, thank you again so much, as always, for your time and insights and brilliance. He's always, listeners, he's always smiling. He's always got this kind of, you know, like positive glow, which helps me at the beginning of the week on a Sunday morning. It's actually why we do this on Sundays. And look forward to chatting next week. And I just want to say that I received a lot of feedback when you were last on 2 weeks ago. We did a longer pod and a lot of people commented that they liked the longer format better. So when we can, when we have the time and ability, God knows we'll never run out of what to talk about. We're going to do a slightly longer one of 40 minutes. Listeners.
Sounds great.
Yeah. Otherwise, we're going to, I thought people wanted shorter format, you know, but hey, the market has spoken. Thank you so much. Have a wonderful week.
You too, Vivian.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the State of Tel Aviv and Beyond podcast. We'll keep the dispatches coming as frequently as we can. If you like what you're hearing, please take a moment, rate us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you're listening. You can check out our full library of articles and podcasts at our website, stateoftelaviv.com. State of Tel Aviv is an independent media venture, and we rely on subscribers to support our work. If you are not yet a paying subscriber, please consider taking the plunge today. Each person really does make a huge difference, especially in these very challenging times in Israel. It is important that you stay informed and current and seek out a range of perspectives. This is a pivotal moment in Israeli history. It is not a time to be passive and disengaged. Thanks for sticking with me to the end. I'm Vivian Berkovich, signing off from deep inside the State of Tel Aviv.